So one of a teaching or an instruction you hear a lot of times from the Kruba Ajahns, including Mumpa Cha, is to sort of de-emphasizing or teach, or I don't know, yeah, like kind of de-emphasizing study, basically. Mm-hmm. And I was wondering if you could talk about the context in which those teachings were given, and maybe how to hold or work with them.
Yeah, well, I mean, I think it is important to have an understanding of the cultural context of because the that emphasizing, like Ajahn Chah, is just learn how to read your heart, don't read books. And one is, of course, they grow up with steeped in Buddhist principles, Buddhist stories, Buddhist teachings. So it's through osmosis they tend to have a very good foundation of basic right view and the principles of the Buddhist teachings. And also in Thailand itself, culturally, there does tend to be a pretty marked difference of a lifestyle of the monks who study and the monks who live in the forest monasteries, the practice monasteries, and so that there tends to be very little vinaya taught and lived in the study monasteries, and and often there's very little practice there. Like when I say very little, I mean really little. So it's there's not much value seen. So it's quite a dichotomy, so that and then also the majority of monks who come to the forest monasteries will oftentimes say have done a few years of study already, so they've got some pretty fundamental understanding and knowledge. Like Ajahn Chah, to the end of his life, to the end of his teaching career, I mean, he would still those teachings from that he studied and learned from the time he was quite young, sort of realize, oh, those are part of the Naktam study courses, and it's just embedded in his memory. So that quoting from the suttas, quoting from different teaching stories, and so that he had a fairly good knowledge, and that's very much the case with most of the teachers. So the emphasis is a lot of that is so there's a cultural context for that. But it's very different for Westerners who, one, have no knowledge of Buddhism, basically, or very little, and culturally, none of the values and none of the fundamental principles that you grow up with. You can't not have a conversation in Thai on a daily basis and not be confronted with impermanence, as a teaching of punya, of meritorious action, of barmi, of kamma, So that it's dukkha. I mean, it's just embedded in the language, and so that it's oftentimes it's not reflected on or recognized so clearly, but it's there. And then as one practices, then this comes up, percolates. I mean, we have different stuff percolate when we start to. You know, it's just the amazing amount of advertising jingles that just, you know, go through the mind. You know, just exposed to so different, and so it and then the language and the principles of Buddhism and the teachings are. We need to learn that, and we need to study it so that we have a grasp of the fundamental teachings and also the vast majority of Thai Buddhists have. A very strong faith in Buddhism, and that's just not something that we don't have, and it has to be built. You can't just wish it into existence. It has to be built, and you have to build that on the foundation of the teachings and the practice. So, but particularly the. I mean, we're, for the most part, we're more versed in intellectual and conceptual framing of ideas, and so that it's important that we study. To have that kind of framing and that lays a foundation for faith, because I think the more one studies the teachings, and the more one is building a case for this is really true. It's like that. Book of Robert Wright's, what is it, Why Buddhism is True, or something like that? You know, which is, I mean, 10 years ago, you'd never find a book like that, with a cover like that. 20, 30, 40, you know, just that would never, it'd never sell. But it's something that there's increased. And he's a evolutionary psychologist, so it's I think that's what he is. Yeah. So he's and he's published already. So I think it was an opportunity for him to put out a statement. Was actually we just sent today. Yeah. Today we just sent a stillness flowing to him, because I read the his book and there's got to be a half a dozen references to Ajahn Chah in the book, I'll bet he'll appreciate it. So sent it to him.
In terms of like building faith. I've actually heard Ajahn Piyadamos like encourage like build like study as building trying to build a personal relationship with the Buddha, like kind of cultivating Buddha Anusati. Does that make sense, or is that?
That's a great way to express it, because I think it's important that it's not just an arid intellectual idea. About some vague principle. I mean, so, I mean, there are very clear principles, but I think your faith in the Buddha is your fundamental. That's what the when they describe what faith is, it's always the Tathagata Bodhisattva. So faith in the awakening of the Tathagata, and so that's a great way of expressing that.
Thinking too about, like, by implication, what you were saying before about the dichotomy of study and forest monasteries. Mm-hmm. So, like, maybe it would be the case in Thailand, then, like, one of the only ways to really study the suttas would be to go to a study monastery, or...
Well, that's the thing, no. That's the problem, is that that's one of the reasons why it's kind of frustrating, and on a certain level, rightly so, is that what you end up studying is a lot of commentary and commentarial stories, so that it's, you get more of the sutta stuff in your naktam tri, naktam pho, naktam ek. I mean, it starts to get more and more commentary, but once you start getting into your Maha degrees, then it's less sutta and more visuddhimagga, the commentaries, abhidhamma, dhammapada commentary, a huge amount of commentarial literature, a lot of training in say Pali poetry of, you know, the 5th century, and so it's a bit I mean, it is, if one's real, this is one of the reasons why Ajahn Buddhadasa packed it in. He got his first Maha degree and was so discouraged that he went back to Sunma. He felt he had enough understanding of Pali that he could start just going at the suttas and studying the suttas himself. Ajahn Mahabua, similar, but in a slightly different way, in the sense of he really focused on the forest practice of Ajahn Mun, which was again, Ajahn Mun was very learned, but it was sort of like you had the freedom to choose what you read and you studied, and that inspired them to read the suttas. doing your classical courses of study, you got that, but it was a minority of your program. The majority was more commentarial, Abhidhamma, classical literature, Sanskrit literature. So that, if monks were interested in practice, I don't want to do this. So Ajahn Buddhadasa was very outspoken. And then he set up his own place, which in the south really there wasn't. Northeast had a, especially in those days, you have to remember that that's this like 1930s, 1940s. Even into the 50s and 60s or 70s, the amount of communication between the different regions was fairly minimal. And the language is very distinct, so that it'd be rare for, say, like a northeasterner to go down to the south, or a southerner to go up to the northeast. And to have communication through public media or something. That was one of the things that Ajahn Buddhadasa did do was create a newsletter, printing press type thing, which his brother, he was Dhammadasa, was the force be making that happen. And then being able to reach out to the intellectuals of the time and being able to, and then being invited to give talks in very public venues say the universities or the court, the justice department of justice, so that his sort of view started to spread from that, and emphasizing, he's taking the Sutta teachings and then trying to make that applicable to daily life and to meditation practice. He gave an early I think it was maybe in the late 50s, early 60s, he gave a very long series of talks on Anapanasati, turned into a three-volume book just on Anapanasati. Now that was really unheard of before.
So it's like sounds like we're pretty blessed in terms of having study guides in English, just so we can learn the basics of Pali and go straight to the suttas.
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. I mean, that's that's one of the benefits of not being brought up in the culture. There's always advantages and disadvantages, benefits and drawbacks. In terms of everything, so there's a benefit that we have in being able to just not even feel compelled or confused by the fact, we'll just go straight to the suttas. Ajahn Buddhadasa was considered really radical. the Northeast, there were monks who were very knowledgeable as well as good teachers, a very good friend of Jaukun Upali, a very exceptional monk who was both, he straddled that practice study divide, and that was somebody who Ajahn Mun would go and check in with and talk with get some guidance from or some perspectives from what did the Buddha say about this? What did the suttas say about this? But he was also somebody who was, one, he was well known for his knowledge, and he was also a skillful teacher, preacher, but he would also take off and go off on Tudong or go and practice in quiet places and then come back.
So even though we have a little bit more of a direct route to the suttas, I mean, there's certainly, you even recently spoken of the dangers in terms of book knowledge, sort of using it to prop up a sense of self or getting into arguments and all this kind of type of stuff. I mean, so can you give some guidance on even in reading suttas, how do we use that in our practice and what are the pitfalls?
Yeah, I think one of the things you spent time online in Buddhist forums before you came here, so I mean the views and opinions are uh, uh, the, multitudinous. And people really stake their claim on a particular view and argue with people. But as soon as you end up in conflict, then you have to start thinking, well, I don't think this is what the Buddha taught. This is supposed to be for the arising of Chaku Karani, Jnana Karani, Upasamaya, Binyaya, Nibbanaya, Sangvatati. So that if that's not arising, that's in that sense of knowledge and vision and a sense of peace and clarity and non-contention. Though that's what really has to be arising, to be in line with the Dhamma. So that so whether one's studying or practicing, those are the things to be looking out for, and the kind of contentious upholding of views and the Madhupindika Sutta where Dandapani sees the Buddha sitting there and comes up and what's your teaching, and in India that's really kind of the lifeblood, the pulse of the religious debate, and if you want to, they're incredible. And then the Buddha is sort of replying, my teaching is one where I don't, we don't need to contend with anybody. And as in the sutta, he makes some smacking of this, puckered his brow, and he stomped off with his stick, it wasn't. So that's a flavor of the teachings, and both in terms of how we implement it and the results that we gain from it. And we start realizing just how much that propping up of views and propping up of self around the views ends up being you end up in conflict. And it doesn't mean you can't have an idea in your mind, you can't think things through, and you can't question. But it's the manner in which one does that, and the way that one pursues it, and and that's certainly in terms of leading a life of practice. The exploration of where those views and what kind of props do we have, or are we trying to have, in order to make this sense of me either comfortable or unique or different in some way, it's so much just keeps coming back to relinquishment and letting go. And as we, again, that relinquishment and letting go is not in order to make one more vacuous. But it's to clear some space for clear thinking. And the Buddha was an incredible clear thinker. But he wasn't trying to indoctrinate anybody into his view. He was giving people the tools by which they could understand views and desire and craving. So.
Another major danger of studying and over-intellectualizing things would be like overestimation, like overestimating yourself, like trying to compare your experience with some list somewhere.
Yeah, that's really true. That certainly happened, because that's oftentimes what one is, again, the desire for that knowledge is trying to find some solid ground. And we look for solid ground, anything really, anything will do. But when you have a clear conceptual model of philosophy, religion, spiritual perspective, then you can create some kind of solidity and basically security. So that we seek our security in having that view and holding to it, that's one of the things that is, it's kind of scary that as you practice, you realize, I've got to let go of that too. But then you realize, of course, the more clearly you see it, then you say, "Oh wow, what a relief! I can put that down." It's like that. What is it? I was just thinking. There's this vague recollection of a Native American story of the. This is like the Turtle Island, and it's just, but it's turtles all the way down, and as it's in Buddhism, it's letting go all the way down. it's just increase, as you keep going, it's just more relinquishment, letting go. But that's what leads to peace, and that's what leads to freedom.
Can you talk, like, related to study, maybe it would be like the topic of memorizing the chants that we do, Patimokkha, suttas, things like that. Have you done any of that practice in your...
Of course, I memorized the Patimokkha and then all the chanting in terms of... You actually get an array of Dhamma vocabulary through the chanting, and that's really very helpful. It's like the chant on the Noble Eightfold Path, and it's just the terminology for, what is right intention? So you have these vague ideas. Nekamma sankapa, abhayabhada sankha, avihingsa sankapa. Those are, and then sort of say, what's the Pali? What's the translation? And then being able to say, that's what the Buddha's pointing to. Or are they... the samma sati and then saying that when the Buddha, each time he defines what is mindfulness of the body, what is mindfulness of the and then there's the atta abhisampajana sati ma vinaya loke abhichato manasa. Those are incredibly important terms to get one's mind around. So it's laying those foundations for practice, and so that the and then the suttas, the Dhammacakka Sutta and the Anatta Lakkhana Sutta, the Adita Pariyaya Sutta, those are like cardinal suttas, where you get the Four Noble Truths, Five Khandhas, the Six Ayatanas, and then their relevance to practice. So as a template for, and of course, so those are great things to be memorizing, to know, and have those terms rolling around in one's mind. And say, well, say that Kundanya bin, I don't know how many suttas he's got memorized now. That's a lot. And you know, those are, you're reciting the teachings and those terminologies you become familiar with, and so that they resonate in the mind, or even just the ordinary morning chanting, evening chanting. Those concepts, we repeat them, and they reverberate through the mind. They'll pop up from time to time, and it's worth paying attention to that when they do, because there's usually something percolating there that is useful. So that the just that so the mind becomes more familiar with those concepts, those ideas, that terminology. But also, I mean, the other aspect of it is just applying the mind to memorizing, which there's not much. I mean, the education system for the last, I don't know, 50, 60, 70 years has really de-emphasized memorization. In some ways it's a good thing, but in others it's a way of applying the mind, which we tend to be a bit deficient at. One of the reasons why I memorized the Patimokkha was I said, I'm really averse to memorizing. I hated memorizing poems and in school, and I hated poems anyway. So, you know, why don't you just say it? You know. Yeah, so there's that sort of, but then okay, the only way to memorize the Patimokkha, you know, 45 pages of Pali. Every day you have to do it. You can't not just sort of, oh, I'll do it for a week or two, and then I'll have a break for a couple of weeks. And every single day you've got to be doing it. And yeah, and then it sticks. And then it's just, oh, wow. I said, you know, it was a real feeling of accomplishment being able to chant the Patimokkha.
So then Mongpa said, I hated why, was that not a good intention, right?
That's not a good intention.
Because I think lots of good looking at intention can cut down lots of gilesa and delusion. I mean, I don't know for lay support. I mean, for us as a lay.
Yeah. Well, I at that time in my life, I wasn't looking at intention.
Have you come to terms with poetry now?
Not really. Not really.
Lumpur, since this book is, you know, seems very relevant to monastics, a lot of the questions are around that. I'm curious what. I think a lot of monastics, you know, at some point struggle with thoughts of disrobal. And I'm curious what encouragements you've given to monks going through rough patches, or what adjustments you've sort of recommended or affected in their lives that have helped them remain in robes even through the rough patch?
Well, I mean, a lot of it is just have to play it by ear. You know, really have to pay attention to what a person is experiencing and then try to tune into that. And then, because if you just give them the party line, that's not very helpful. So it's like really being able to tune, well, where is the area of difficulty? Where is the area of frustration? And then try to address that in some way, or to give encouragement in some way, or to just even getting people because oftentimes you get really wound up of how difficult it is, or how hopeless they are, or how irritating and frustrating everybody else is, and just like just being wound up and just, I don't know how to dissipate that, and just hold it a bit more lightly, and not let it be such a oppressive presence. And that's usually, that helps a different perspective to come in.
Sometimes Ajahn Anand would send monks to get ice cream on the beach.
Yeah, I mean, that's from, you know, from the time of the Buddha. That was one of the duties of the acharya or the upacharya, is if the student or disciple is living dissatisfied, then to take them on tudong, take them off. Not in some miserable tudong, but, you know, take... but, you know, get a change of scene. You know, a change of scene, a change of people, or a new perspective coming in.
There's a phrase in the video, wear them down with chanting.
Another teaching that I've heard you give in that situation is recollecting one's initial intention. Why did you become a monk? What was the initial intention?
Yeah, that's true. Yeah, because oftentimes that gets easily forgotten when one's when one's frustrated or hit a wall, doesn't feel like one's getting anywhere, and then to really bring up that recollection of, well, what was it that was the inspiration for going forth? You realize that it's not that far away from one, but it can get obscured and clouded and forget that, oh yeah, I was actually inspired by these teachings and this practice at one time.
Here in a lot of monasteries, and I don't know how it was in Thailand, but in terms of here we, during our third vasa, we go to another monastery. Mm-hmm. I think that was something, moving around was also something that happened too in Thailand. And I was wondering if you could share a little bit about that and the role that plays in our training.
Well, I think, one is here, we take that opportunity, third pansa, to experience practice in another place, another situation. Usually one's been, say, an anagarika for a year, after training for several months. So I've been an anagarika for a year, been a novice for a year, been a monk for a couple of years, and I'm probably ready for something. And so then having the opportunity to go and study at another monastery, generally it would be within our tradition, and so that there's some continuity, but it's an opportunity to view one's own training and one's own community with fresh eyes, coming back, or while one's away, and then getting a perspective on the training from a different teacher, a different angle, different way of approaching, and that's usually very helpful. Here in America, choices are pretty limited, which I like. That was one of the frustrations I felt at Wat Nanachat was monks were, always moving, and it was really hard to develop a feeling of community, a continuity of community, because people are coming and going all the time. And it wasn't as if they were coming and going of like, doing anything bad, but there wasn't a steadiness of over time. So it was hard to develop a strong feeling of community here with just being in America. Then we have, it's only recently that we've got two options to go to in America. So that's it's an so it's what it does is like what it has done is created a strong sense of okay, whoever's here is generally committed to being here, and that creates stronger community and I think a lot more kind of competence in dealing with other human beings, and just having to live in close quarters with people over time. It's just the mind easily conjures up some irritation or some kind of idea of what somebody else is thinking, what they mean by what they're doing, and it's just usually conjured up out of one's own particular biases and confusion and if you keep moving, then it's all very real. But if you live with it and watch it and see it change, and you end up saying, "Oh, Mom, why did I think that? That's really weird." And you get to know somebody and you realize, "Oh, they're very different than what I thought they were." And it's a so there's a lot more. I think maturity in dealing with people. So in terms of practice and in terms of skills of community, one, of course, having that continuity is great. But then it's nice to have a break and both to see another community. how they do things. Because sometimes people will come back from being away with ideas that are been implemented here, and it's been really useful for the community.
When one is either for their third vasa, thinking about where to go, or maybe after their fifth vasa, deciding where to go, what are some general parameters or guidelines that you might give to somebody looking, you know, where they should go?
For, after their fifth vasa?
Maybe, when you're deciding, when you're living in one community and you have an option to go live somewhere else for a period of time,
right,
what would be good things to consider for, a choice of another community?
Well, I think, thinking in terms of say, a teacher, a community that one feels, I'd like to draw close to that teacher or that community for various reasons. Their teaching, their practice, or of course, with Thailand, and it's majority have gone to Thailand, and then that's an opportunity to not just to draw closer to the roots of say the Ajahn Chah and Ajahn Chah tradition, but then also to experience the Thai culture, Thai Buddhist culture, and that's a perspective that is really helpful and supportive for practice, I think. So there's these different aspects of what one's looking at that one feels would be helpful for one's ongoing growth and commitment to the training. Okay, I think we have a break.